the latest episode of In the Mix with Leah B. I am your host, Leah B, where I provide a history lesson on all things related in Black music and culture. So, hope you guys are having a fantastic weekend. Happy Saturday to all of you. Hope it's warm wherever you are. It's starting to get warm over here, finally, in Detroit. And, yeah, I hope you guys are having an awesome, you know, Saturday. Yeah, so this episode is episode 65. I cannot believe I am at 65. We're at 65. It's just amazing. And this episode is the third episode of the Blue Eye Soul series that is currently happening right now. The last episode last week. And this week, the episode is on John B. Yes, John B. How I discovered him was, I remember watching BET Planet Groove. And I remember as a kid, seeing him, I thought homeboy was like a light-skinned black dude. I knew he was fine, but I thought he was like Spanish or something. Either I knew he wasn't white, and I thought he was like either Spanish or like some light-skinned like black dude. But when I discovered, once I found out he was white, I was like, oh my goodness, dude can sing. He was awesome. Like, and I became a fan since then. And I remember the video that came out. It was They Don't Know. And yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's get into this episode. Yes. Yeah, so he was born November of 74. So he's like 10 years young, older than me. And I was born in 84. But anyway. Yeah, he was born in 74, and he was born in Rhode Island. His parents are musical, very musical as well. So he grew up in a musical family. His dad was a professor of music at California State University and was the director of one of the symphony orchestras in there, I guess one of the classes in there, and he was the director of that whole department there. And his mom was a concert pianist, and that's how he learned how to play keyboards when he was like 9 or whatever. And as soon as he started working on the keyboards, he was playing the bass and the drums as well. Oh, and his brother was also who became a celloist. Like, he played the cello. And his sister as well actually received a degree at Juilliard. So his family was very involved into the whole classical genre of music. That's how he, you know, got his start, I guess you could say. And but he wasn't really interested in classical music. He was more into anything that had a beat, pretty much. So when he basically drummed on everything, anything that had a good sound, that's what he gravitated to. And when he moved to California when he was young, his grandparents had a actual record store. And that's while he was in the record store, he got his influences from Earth, Wind, and Fire, Rod Stewart, the Bee Gees, Donna Summer, And his grandparents allowed him to, borrow the records and let him play with them on a, small turntable and whatnot at home, at his home. As he grew up, as he got older, he started listening to Stevie Wonder, Babyface, Mint Condition, and D'Angelo. And that's when he began writing his own songs as well. Through his connects, his father had a friend, he was a musical director at the Grammy Awards, and that's when he attended, he was enrolled in the LA County High School for the Performing Arts, and that's where he met all these top executives from top record companies and whatnot. So by the time he got in high school, people were taking interest, and he was trying to get a record deal while he was in high school, but people, weren't really feeling him. They told him that he sounded too black. So he was like, you know what? Let me graduate and then make this happen. So by the time he graduated from high school, he had a demo tape, and that's when his influences he was listening to actually took a listen to his demo tape, and that was Babyface. And during that time, he was when he was married to Tracy Edmonds, him, Babyface, and Tracy formed a record label called Yam Yum Records. And when he got signed, I think he was his first artist on that record label. And so in the mid 90s, he was honing his craft, and he was writing and producing music for artists, other musicians, before he actually got a debut album. So he was getting his foot wet in the industry after he graduated from high school. And with the blessing of Tracy Edmonds, who was the president of the record label, of his record label, he was able to write songs for various artists that were hot at that time. He had so many songs that she showed like 50 of his songs that he had written for Toni Braxton, After Seven, New Edition, Color Me Bad, a group, artist named D.D. O'Neill, and another artist named Rock Track. And so all those songs that he wrote caught the attention of a singer by the name of Peter Gabriel. He was kind of popular in the 70s. And with him taking a look at his songs, listening to his songs, he was impressed. Peter Gabriel was so impressed that he actually invited him, John B., to a recording week in London, England, which it was a collaboration of songwriters and producers from all over the world. So it was like what you call a boot camp. So it was like a songwriting boot camp. And so they would lend talent, their songwriting talents to Peter Gabriel's album that he was creating on his record label called Real World, the Real World label. With this, by him doing that, working, that was part of the strategy that Tracy was trying to build in him. So she was saying, basically, she said that we knew we needed this credibility as a marketing tool because he was a white guy doing R&B music. So if they didn't know who he was, if they knew who he was as a white guy singing R&B, a lot of R&B stations would not play his music. So, by him going, doing all that songwriting and going to that boot camp, it actually worked. And by the time when he turned 19, that's when he did that duet with Babyface called Someone to Love. And that peaked at number 11. It actually hit number 11 on the Billboard Hot 100 and debuted at number 8 on the Billboard Hot R&B singles chart. And his debut album, Bonafide, which was produced by Tracy Edmonds, quickly moved up to the Billboard Hot 100 within 3 months, and it sold over 58,000 copies. So he was saying that, he quoted on Billboard magazine, he said his race did not make any difference in his career, saying that in most cases, people didn't even see it as an issue, especially when they heard him sing. And he told the Atlanta Constitution that his first album, he was getting told that how to, tell them how to like sing, how to look and stuff, because they wanted it to be a careful, the record label wanted him to have this polished look when you thought of a white guy singing black music. And they weren't used to that. And he said, people, quote, he said people really didn't really know how to take a guy that looked like him singing the music he was singing. And he looked up to Babyface, and he said he viewed Babyface as a mentor. And he said doing a duet with him was the highlight of everything. And by 1990, by the summer of 95, Bonafide, his debut album, viewed an appearance on the Jay Leno show. And it became extremely popular by that time. By 1990, six, they believed that he could go international, so that's what he did. He did a promotional tour to promote the album in Europe and Asia. And by 97, he was working on his debut, his second sophomore album called Cool Relax, which spent over 37 weeks on the Billboard R&B albums chart, and it sold over 530. It did even better, and it sold over 5,337 copies, and it went platinum. And by that time, his look was a lot different. It was more hip hop, R&B vibe, and that's when the song They Don't Know came out, and that became his biggest hit off that album. And I forgot another song off there too, but Cool Relax was a good album. I liked it, and I got it like what, 20 years later. But so with his success, a lot of people, you have haters, and people were concerned about his image, where they were, he even said he loved the hip hop culture and he had the chance to show it. And with his second album, he had more creative control, and because he just basically stayed in the studio and nobody really, got him and stuff. So as his success grew, him as his success grew, he had a lot of haters. And he basically said, you got to have haters to have lovers. And people were basically saying that, like, dude, why is this white dude trying to sing R&B? But despite of his background being, you know, in classical music, he grew up influenced by the hip hop scene. So, and that's how people took it, and people still, you know, enjoy him to this day. And so by 1998, he, you know, started acting, getting, like, you know, offers to act and everything, getting acting roles, but he never pursued them. And he felt like that will take away from his music if he did acting and all that stuff. But he did direct music videos. And he was inspired by Erykah Badu, Wyclef, Lauryn Hill. And by 99, that's when he got married to his girlfriend, Millie Music Callaway. And she was also a performer as well. She sang backup for Macy Gray, Nikki Costa. And by that time, by 99, he started working on his third album called Pleasures You Like. And he had Babyface, of course, Nas, Cuban Link, AZ, Faith Evans, my bad. And so when he was working on that, that was released in 2001. They called it, that album is syrupy with a mix of, you know, various tunes. But it had a good R&B feel. I actually like that album. I don't have it, but I just remember it. And the song on there was called Don't Talk. Something like that. Yeah. But anyway, while in 2001, he actually put a group together called Deluxe and Dominique Quinn to create a new band called Jack Hera. So they were his, like, backup singers. And so while he was on tour in Europe, they, you know, formed that group, had that group called Jack Hera. And they were writing songs and all that stuff. And by the end of the year, you know, by the end of the tour, they had material for a new album. So Jack Hera was like his alter ego, you can say. And they were just vibing. And that the Jack Hera project did okay. It had like a hip hop feel to it, and it was mostly live instruments and all that stuff. But the group was signed to the same label. He was Yab Yum 550, which was a Sony record. So he continued to record as outside of that group with the new group. And so Jack Hera didn't really do as well, I guess you can say, because I don't remember. I think I remembered maybe not no songs at all. So they didn't really do too well, pretty much. So yeah, so John B, he's still performing. He's still singing. But he went independent after working on the label. So he went independent, started still making records, but I haven't heard anything in a while. But he's still making records and everything. And I think he's no longer married to Music Calloway. He got remarried and he got some had some kids with another young lady and whatnot as well. So yes, y'all, hope you guys have, this is the end of episode 65, and this episode, the next episode, it will be on Tina Marie. So look out for that. If you guys want to follow the podcast, I'm on all streaming platforms, not streaming, but all social media. In the Mix with Leah B on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and also have a website, in the Mix with Leah B.com. And y'all forgive me. I'm trying to get the podcast merch together. I'm trying to figure that all out. I might have to make my own designs, but we shall see about that. But anyway, I thank you guys for listening. I appreciate you and enjoy you. Love y'all very much. I'm glad y'all still rocking with a girl, with your girl. And y'all be blessed. Stay tuned for the next episode. All right, y'all. Peace and love.